Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with another case of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank, with Donald Trump's nomination of Andrew Puzder, the CEO of Hardee's and Carl's Jr.'s fast food chain, who is a relentless foe of raising the minimum wage and paying workers overtime, yet will be heading up the Department of Labor tasked with enforcing workplace safety and wage laws on behalf of American workers. Fred Rotondaro, a member of the Patriotic Millionaires, who was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress working on poverty and inequality, joins us to discuss how this nomination will put the brakes on a raise in the minimum wage and overtime pay, since Puzder has made it clear he thinks giving a worker a fancy job title helps them more than paying them a living wage. Puzder also believes that food stamps discourage poor people from working, and machines are better than humans because, quote, they're always polite, they always upsell, they never take vacations, they never show up late, and there's never a slip and fall or an age, sex, or race discrimination case. Then we'll speak with David Shanzer, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University. He was staff director of the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security, and we will discuss Donald Trump's nomination for Secretary of Homeland Security, General John Kelly, who will be the third general nominated to a top position in the Trump administration, with General David Petraeus a possible fourth. We'll examine how a military mindset might adjust to civilian challenges in an agency that will oversee the Coast Guard, the Secret Service, the Border Patrol, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And then finally, we'll examine efforts to abolish the antiquated Electoral College that twice in recent years has resulted in the loser of the popular vote winning the presidency. A Pulitzer Prize-winning expert on the Founding Fathers and the Constitution, Jack Rakoff, a professor of history and American studies at Stanford University and the author of Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America, joins us to discuss his testimony this week before the House Judiciary Committee on the Future of the Electoral College. And joining us now is Fred Rotondaro, who's the chair of the Board of Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good and a member of the Patriotic Millionaires, who has had a varied career that includes journalism, teaching, anti-poverty and civil rights work, and National Association management. Previously, he was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he concentrated on poverty and inequality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fred Rotondaro.
Thank you very much, and I'm delighted to be here.
And do you see this, as I do, as another case of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank?
Absolutely. I think it is a total betrayal of everything that Donald Trump told the American workers, told blue-collar workers. He told them he was going to support them. He told them he was going to fight for them. He has given them a horrible Secretary of Labor. I don't think there's any question about it.
But he won the election because he did reach out to blue-collar workers. That is what most pundits are saying now, particularly in those Rust Belt states of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And, in fact, critics of the Clinton campaign make that clear, that the traditional Democratic base was ignored by the Clinton campaign, but Donald Trump really went after them. So is this a case of being seduced and abandoned?
I think it is. They were seduced. They are being abandoned. I come from Luzerne County in the Scranton area in Pennsylvania. Wall Street Journal just did a story about the people up there who are longtime union activists who are strong believers in work and family, who have been longtime Democrats who voted for Donald Trump. They had come to a conclusion, and I'm very sad to say that I agree with part of this. They had come to a conclusion that they had been, they'd been fed a line of nonsense over the course of years by Republicans. Democratic Party still has good programs for them, wonderful programs, but they really didn't go after blue collars this year. They haven't done that for a number of years. It was dumb on the part of the Clinton campaign. I speak as someone who strongly supported Hillary Clinton, but I certainly was not very happy with their approach to blue collar workers. As a matter of fact, just as an aside, I'm part of a very small group of Democratic activists in Washington who are working on the topic right now of the importance of blue collar workers. I come from coal country, Yen. My father was a coal miner. He went into the mines at the age of 11. My father once told me, he was a little bit extreme, he never met a Republican he liked. But he always used to believe, son, kid, the Democrats are for the little people. And they are, but they didn't demonstrate that this year. And Donald Trump walked away with them. He seduced them.
Well, but how, in other words, how long does it, will the, what's the gap between the seduction and the abandonment? We'd already, we're talking about weeks, right? Or almost a month, you know, I mean, that's pretty breathtaking.
I think the abandonment begins, I think the abandonment begins strongly today with the announcement or about to be announcement of Posner. But before this, some of the people Donald Trump has put in charge of HHS, they're going to be going after. They're going to be going after the Affordable Care Act. Republicans are going to be going after Medicare. We know that. Republicans are going to be trying to privatize Social Security. These are all programs that benefit blue collar workers. They were put into effect by Franklin Roosevelt. They were put into effect by Lyndon Johnson. They've been godsends for the average American man or woman. And Trump, who I think is playing the role of impresario, I sort of view Trump as being a wonderful performance artist in the tradition of Justin B., while Mike Pence is very quiet, Vice President-elect and an extraordinarily conservative governor and congressman, while Mike Pence is giving away the federal treasures to big business that is looking exclusively simply to make more and more money. I view the Secretary of Labor position as really a disaster. You needed in that post a creative, a smart guy who would look to other countries, who would look to the think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, a very conservative but a very strong think tank, and say, how can we help blue-collar workers? Instead, he is the epitome of a minor league Don Trump saying, I'm a businessman, I made it on my own, I know what I know, nobody knows as much as I do. This man does not have the breadth of intellect. He does not have the depth of intellect to do what needs to be done. And yet he's being given this enormously important post. This is a betrayal. There's no other way of calling it anything else.
And again, I'm speaking with Fred Rodendaro, who's the chair of the Board of Catholics and Alliance for the Common Good and a member of the Patriotic Millionaires, who has been has had a varied career that includes journalism, teaching in anti-poverty and civil rights work and National Association management. And previously, he was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he concentrated on poverty and inequality. So if we have this kind of tag team of Donald Trump as the entertainer in chief. I mean, I think that what we've seen so far are the contours of government by stunt, by you know, the carrier turns out to be a stunt. Then the canceling the Air Force One may actually have been a spiteful and petty act on Trump's part, because the CEO of Boeing was mildly critical of Trump's threatening trade wars, and their stock tanked as a result of that. And he completely exaggerated and lied about the $4 billion. It's the contract that Boeing has is for $170 million. And then, of course, you have the Japanese businessman holding up a piece of paper saying, I'm going to invest $50 billion and create 50,000 jobs. All of those are brief kind of photo op moments. And meanwhile, as you say, Pence is doing the heavy lifting and turning the government over to the most powerful corporations and wealthy families. Now, Pence, as you mentioned, Pence or alluded to, the Pence is an extremely religious man, very, very, you know, a very committed member of what we call the religious right. How do you square this with religion, though? The Bible talks about the least among us. I mean, here you have this guy, Fred Puzda, who honestly believes or said that giving food stamps to the poor discourages them from working. I mean, that's just manifestly cruel and untrue.
It is. It's something that Trump and Republicans have been able to capitalize on very, very well for a number of years. A good friend of mine, a guy named Bill DeAntonio at Catholic University of America, does every 2 years a poll of American Catholics. Inevitably, American Catholics cite helping the poor as one of their top two or three priorities. Inevitably, white American Catholics vote for Republican nominees. This time around, white American males Catholics voted for Trump, something like 64-30. Abortion is part of an issue, but it's more than that. Republicans play on themes of God, of abortion, service to country, all the while that they are doing what the scholars Paul Pearson at the University of California and Jacob Packer at Yale say they're getting off center. They are masters at distraction. And Trump, I think, is the culmination of the ability to distract the American public. I just saw on television Kellyanne Conway, who was the Trump campaign manager, is now a senior advisor, and she was asked about Puzda, and she said, he's a great choice. He's a great job creator, and all of his people made lots of money. That is a very simple lie. There's no other way of putting it. He hired people into jobs at his hamburger joints, paid the minimum wages, while he was walking away with tens of millions of dollars, won't give them benefits, won't increase that wage, will fight against it. Kellyanne Conway is lying, pure and simple. And the Trump campaign is going to do more and more and more of that. I noticed, you might have picked up on it, that the Harvard discussion about a week ago, Ms. Conway said Donald Trump did not conduct a racist campaign. That's how he started his campaign, and that's how he continued his campaign. The biggest tragedy, I think, of Donald Trump's presidency is not going to be what happens in the next 4 years. Democrats will fight. They're going to be tougher than you might expect. But the fact that Donald Trump got to be president by appealing to the worst, the lowest elements in the American public, he made the American public, he made American voters think poorly of themselves and act well below what they should. He has, in effect, destroyed American ideals, and the people he's got around him are going to be doing exactly the same thing.
Well, there's something deeply cynical. I mean, first of all, the choice announced today, and which I covered yesterday, which is the head of the EPA, another Dracula in charge of the blood bank, that's sort of in-your-face cynical. He's putting in a global warming denier and a guy that spent all of his time as the Attorney General of Oklahoma suing the EPA. So, again, you've got somebody that's hostile to the very mission that they're supposed to take over. But in terms of his attitudes to labor and to workers that work for him at Carl's Jr. and Hardee's, he's gone on record saying that he sort of likes to give them these fancy job titles instead of giving them a living wage. In other words, he thinks that you boost somebody's morale by calling them a deputy manager of food services, but you pay him less than $15 an hour. In fact, he's arguing about the actual $8 or seven something minimum wage, isn't he? Isn't that what he wants?
$7.25, right. Exactly. He doesn't think the minimum wage should be raised above $9. Minimum wage of one person, $9 an hour, 40 hours a week. You're not even making poverty wages. You can't survive on that. And for Trump to appoint this guy is, as you said at the beginning of the hour, I don't think there's any other way of putting it except this is the betrayal of the American worker.
So what can the American worker do? There's the fight for 15. I mean, obviously they've been dealt a blow, but they've got a lot of national attention. And this is where I think this is a targeted piece of cynicism on the part of Donald Trump, because you've got a guy that runs the fast food restaurants, chains, and the Fight for 15 is largely focused on McDonald's and these fast food chains. So the coincidences are inescapable, isn't it?
Oh, I think you're right, that it is inescapable. As I noted a little bit earlier, we're at a point where American workers need some serious thinking from the Democrats, but also from the Republicans. This guy is not a serious thinker. This guy is an in-your-face businessman. I know everything there is to know. He talked about Obama hurting American business. Does the man see how many jobs have been added to the American economy since Obama came on board? Does the man see where the stock market has gone under Obama? And by the way, on that, people have mentioned the stock market is doing very well under Trump, and I point out to them the top three stocks are that are doing so well are Goldman, Morgan Chase, and United Healthcare. The money is going right back where it always was, to the people at the very top of the economic ladder. Obama had a broad-based economic recovery that he accomplished in the teeth of the obstacles put up for him by the same people that had helped cause the recession.
Right, and he also came to office when the economy is in a free fall because of the crash that happened under George W. Bush's predecessor, and has spent 8 years fighting his way back, and now he's got an economy that's got incredibly good statistics in terms of job creation and low unemployment. So he's handing this gift to Donald Trump, who ran on the platform that the sky was falling and everything is terrible, and only I can come ride to the rescue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very important point. The economy was losing something like 800 jobs, 1,000 jobs a month when Obama took over. The unemployment rate was around 10%. And now the unemployment rate, as I think last Friday, is 4.6%, which highlights another problem with so many of the Trump voters. There's a sizable percentage of Trump voters who think that the jobless rate under Obama has increased. They have been beaten up so often by Fox News, by Rush Limbaugh. They have been given spots of news that are not news. They're lies. And they've come to believe that. And Trump capitalized on that, I would say, very, very well. And Posner is going to try to capitalize on, I'm a businessman, I created these jobs. He is a businessman who made out very, very well for himself and did it on the backs of his low-income workers. He will have nothing to offer the American labor market. He will have nothing to offer American workers because he doesn't think that way. He doesn't have the kind of speculative, deep vision that, say, someone like Robert Reich did when he was Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. He doesn't think those ways. He thinks of, how do I maximize profit for myself and my managers and for my board? Not the workers deserve a decent salary. They're not going to get it.
And it's the workers who basically make fast food happen, don't they?
That's exactly right.
And he'd rather give them a phony title.
A title.
Well, just in closing, Fred Rotondara, I feel like every day when I pick up the newspaper, I'm getting my daily dose of doom. And every day we hear another these announcements from the Trump administration, and they just seem to get worse. So
they do. And your point before was entertainer in chief. Donald Trump is attacking the union guy who pointed out that his claims about saving jobs at Carrier Plant were exaggerated. He's into several other fights, one with the chairman of Boeing. Meanwhile, people like the Environmental Protection Chief, Jeff Chessens, as Attorney General, this man today, Posner, these people are coming right down the pipeline. And will likely get confirmed. Although I do think some of the Democrats are going to beat up on them pretty well, and I think very importantly, the Donald Trump voters are going to very quickly come to the conclusion they've been taken.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Fred Rotondaro.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it immensely.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Fred Rotondaro, who's the chair of the board of Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good and a member of the Patriotic Millionaires, who has had a varied career that includes journalism, teaching, anti-poverty and civil rights work, and National Association management. Previously, he was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he concentrated on poverty and inequality. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of Homeland Security.
Bottom don't lag behind. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working band blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul. Tossed by the winds and the seas, I'll drag them.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Shanzer, who's Associate Professor of the Practice and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the Sanford Public School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic Staff Director of the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as the Legislative Director for Senator Gene Carnahan, Counsel to Senator Joseph Biden, and Counsel to Senator William Cohen. His positions in the executive branch also included special counsel to the Office of the General Counsel of the Department of Defense and trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Shanzer.
Happy to be with you.
Well, thank you, David. And Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of Homeland Security, General John Kelly, will be the third general nominated to a top position in his administration, with General David Petraeus a possible fourth. So let's start with that, because there's been some discussion about General Mad Dog Mattis at the DOD. As you know, they have to sign Congress have to vote on a waiver because he has not been out of uniform for 7 years, which is the law. They want to give him an exception. You've got General Flynn at National Security Advisor, who is troublesome for a whole bunch of reasons. And then now you've got this third general, John Kelly. What's your sense then of the broader issues of the civilian control of the military? But you would think, though, that Homeland Security would even require more civilian control.
Well, I think there are some general points to be made on this issue, on looking at it from both perspectives. First, if you look at these four-star generals, Flynn was a three-star general. I mean, those are some very talented people. They've been down-selected just to become a flag officer of any sort from many, many thousands of officers to actually even earn one star, and then to make it through all the general officers. It's a very elite group. And we're talking about very talented individuals, and they're not just military men. They're not just fighters. These four-star generals are important representatives of our government. They engage in diplomacy. They interact with heads of state from countries in their jurisdiction. They deal with very complex problems. So I think we're talking about some very talented individuals. And as a general matter, I certainly don't have any problem with the president looking to that talent pool, as, for example, President Obama did with General Shinseki to run the head of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Then there's the question of, you know, how many generals is it kind of healthy to have in civilian positions in the government? And there I would say, you know, certainly having a couple is not a problem, but, you know, military folks do tend to look at problems. They've spent their life in a particular culture. There's a famous saying that if all you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. And so I think you want to bring more diversity to your decision-making, your national security decision-making. People who come from the areas of diplomacy, people who have worked inside the civilian, people who understand domestic and congressional politics. These positions require understanding of politics. So those are things I'd be worried about if you had too many generals in the cabinet.
Well, one of the here we are sort of questioning Donald Trump's choices, but in a curious way, the choice of General Kelly is being seen with some sort of sigh of relief amongst those concerned about immigration policy, because he didn't choose the Secretary of State of Kansas, Chris Kobach, who's a sort of zealous ideologue. So I guess the bar has been lowered.
Yeah, if you look at General Kelly's experience in terms of being the four-star in charge of the United States Southern Command, so this is somebody who has spent some serious time thinking about the issues relating to Central and South America, who understands the issues of drugs and narcotic car trafficking, criminal gangs, and the impact it's having on these countries, had to deal with migration issues, public health issues like the Zika virus. And so a lot of that actually will inform some of the things that you have to deal with in Homeland Security, which is questions of immigration, questions of border security, questions of public health issues. I think he has some relevant experience. But again, being a general and working in the military, it's a very, very different context. Being head of a civilian agency that's acting, within the constitutional and domestic law framework that the Department of Homeland Security has to act within.
And a lot of analysts are saying that they think that General Kelly's position on Guantanamo helped him get the job, because he's been very outspoken that he wants to keep Guantanamo open, and that he feels that it's the best place to put the people that are there. Even though, as you know, President Obama made a pledge to close it and has been unable to do so.
Yeah, well, I think that's a bit of a red herring. I mean, DHS has basically nothing to do with Guantanamo. It's mm-hmm. the Department of Defense facility, and that's a decision that's going to be made by the president. Trump has made it clear that he wants to, use this, law of war paradigm. Continue to use it and see if it can actually be beefed up from what President Obama has done. So that's an issue that was decided in the election. I don't think it really comes down to the question of what the appointees do, because whoever's appointed, I think, will follow the president's lead on that.
And again, I'm speaking with David Shanza, who's Associate Professor of the Practice and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. And previously, he was the Democratic Staff Director of the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as a Legislative Director for Senator Gene Carnahan, counsel to Senator Joseph Biden, and counsel to Senator William Cohen. So I mentioned that some groups concerned with a more compassionate immigration policy were somewhat relieved that it wasn't Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas. But how do you think the general's sort of background? You mentioned how, since he was head of Southern Command, that he's been dealing with southern border issues and drugs coming in from Central South America, the Caribbean, or through the Caribbean, and how that may come into play. One of the thorniest parts of this immigration situation has been the unaccompanied children that came in largely from El Salvador, which is a country which is almost teetering on being a failed state because of drug gangs, two of the main ones having been literally born here in Los Angeles. and there's this kind of revolving door between these MS-13 gangsters and the 18th Street gangs coming into the U.S., getting deported back to El Salvador, where they terrorize young people, and parents basically send their young kids on this hazardous journey unaccompanied through Mexico all the way to the United States to hand themselves in. It's a tragic human situation. What do you think he can bring to the table in terms of solving that?
Well, I think, as you've laid out, I think what General Kelly, having had the experience he has, will be very well equipped to articulate the connectivity between the issue, events that happened abroad and the circumstances there and the plight of individuals that are inside the United States or are migrating there, and try to explain that to the president and bring those issues to bear in policy. And I'll mind you that this was not an easy decision or issue at all for the Obama administration. Made a decision that, many of the children who migrated would actually have to be deported and couldn't stay here permanently. A lot of those cases are in adjudication. As an aside, we had the Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, at Duke, and I was interviewing him, and we had a protest in the audience of an individual who was one of these children who had come migrated, and was in a local high school and then was picked up by ICE and detained, and he was let out again, and then he unfurled and started shouting out. And this is a very, very contentious issue, even for the liberal Obama administration. And I think what we're going to see, frankly, on immigration is a lot of hot rhetoric. But I think just as it did for the Obama and the Bush and the Clinton administration before it, this is a difficult political issue. There aren't easy decisions. There's humanitarian grounds. And I think those are going to be brought to bear on the president when he's actually governing and has to make decisions that impact real people in a real context, and it's not about rhetoric during a campaign rally. And so, we'll see where it goes. I'm not optimistic about the course of policy, but I think these human factors, I think General Kelly will, be able to articulate that to the new president.
And this is a president who's, when he announced he's running for president, vilified Mexicans, spent his entire campaign talking about building a wall, which he's not talking about much at all. So just in the last minute or so, David Chancellor, you think that Donald Trump can be brought educated and have a more compassionate approach? Or do you hope?
Hope springs eternal. I just think, reality comes to bear. And the realities of the situation, none of these problems are as simple as they, seem from the campaign trail or when you're not making decisions that impact real people. And I think once those decisions are starting to be made and the wheels start to grind, there's going to be pushback from a lot of directions that are going to impact the president, people close to him, things he cares about. I think he started moving towards a position where he said, we just really want to get rid of the criminal aliens. That's who I think is causing problems for America. Well, that was the Obama administration policy. 100% was that anyone who was engaged in violent felonies and was inside the United States and didn't have a legal status, they were at the top of the list for deportation. So we'll see if Trump, does a Obama maybe plus some tweaks here or there, or if he really, really, dramatically overhauls U.S. immigration policy and starts a campaign of mass deportations and unravels the status for these young people who didn't come here illegally themselves, they came with their parents. I don't see that happening because I think the political tumult will be too great. Hope springs eternal, though, I'd say.
Well, David Chancellor, I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, well, I enjoyed chatting with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with David Shanza, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic staff director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as a legislative director for Senator Gene Carnahan, counsel to Senator Joseph Biden, and counsel to Senator William Cohen. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into questions now arising and efforts to abolish the antiquated Electoral College. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jack Rakoff. Jack Rakoff, who is a professor of history and American studies at Stanford University, who was awarded the 1997 Pulitzer Prize for History for his book, Original Meanings, Politics and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution. His latest book is Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jack Rakoff.
Happy to be here.
And there was a meeting recently, a few days ago, in fact, in Washington, D.C., amongst the Democrats, trying to figure out what to do about the Electoral College, given that they had a substantial victory in the popular vote, getting close to 3 million, that Hillary Clinton is ahead of Donald Trump. But nevertheless, under our Constitution, that is somewhat meaningless because she didn't win the Electoral College. So there have been attempts in the past to get rid of the Electoral College, but they haven't gone far because it requires a constitutional amendment. So what were the Democrats talking about in Washington the other day?
Well, I participated in that hearing, and it was designed to discuss both the history of the Electoral College and different proposals and reasons for its reform. But one thing we talked about was what's called the National Popular Vote, which is a movement to get states with 270 electoral votes, meaning majority of the whole, to commit their electors to vote for whichever candidate has the popular plurality or the popular majority. And somewhat to my surprise, that idea seemed fairly attractive to the Democratic members of Congress. I'm pretty skeptical about it myself, and happen to think we would do better, you know, as difficult as it might be, to struggle our way to try to get an Article 5 constitutional amendment and to try to find some way to, you know, to pitch that to the American people as a whole.
Well, the initiative is, on the surface, makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? It's simple. It's an end run around the Electoral College by getting each state to pledge that their electors will match the popular vote. But if it were to succeed, or if you get a critical mass, wouldn't you automatically have a constitutional challenge?
Yes, I think you would, and I think that constitutional challenge would be likely to prevail. There's a basic problem, at least as I see it, with the so-called NPV, the National Popular Vote Initiative. There is a clause in the Constitution which requires compacts among or between the states to receive congressional approval. Now, the advocates for the NPV argue that there's a line of cases which might make it easier for the states simply to agree with each other without having Congress approve. But I'm very skeptical about that. The idea of kind of amending the circumstances for electing the most important officer in the land by a partial process involving a limited number of states, a question which has the first order of constitutional magnitude, the idea that you could do it in this ingenious but still somewhat dubious way, it just seems to me that's very dubious. It would be challenged by some members of Congress. It would probably be challenged by voters in particular states. And I think once those challenges were made, you'd find yourself smack that back in terms of the basic problem of trying to have the Constitution formally amended rather than kind of engineered through a backdoor technique.
So the final vote for this presidential election takes place with the 538 members of the Electoral College on December the 19th. And already there have been some defectors, or what have been traditionally called faithless electors. There is a paramedic and former firefighter who was one of the first responders on September 11th, Christopher Sumprin, who wrote in the New York Times that Trump was someone who shows daily that he's not qualified for the office. He is supposed to cast his vote for Trump, but won't on conscience. And then he was joined by Art Cisneros, another Republican elector in Texas. There seem more like gestures than a possible large-scale defection. I mean, technically speaking, the Constitution does not specify how the electors are supposed to vote, does it?
No, it's really, you know, what the framers of the Constitution did was to default the decision about who the electors would be, how they would be appointed, and presumably how they would act. It left all that to the state legislatures. I think it did it primarily because the framers of the Constitution worked out their plans for the Electoral College literally at the very end of their debates. You might say they ran out of gas, but I think it's more likely that they did not have a convenient answer available as to who the electors would be or the basis on which they're going to act. So they left that to the states, and I think there's a lot of residual ambiguity as to just how much freedom the electors actually have. You know, a number of states bind their electors to follow the decision of the electorate. I think that's probably the correct decision, but we've never really tested. There have been something like 157 faithless electors in the past. There was one back in 2000, a Democratic elector in the District of Columbia who threw away her vote for Gore as a protest that D.C. ought to become a state. But it's never mattered in the past. You know, an odd elector here, an odd elector there. There's nothing really to litigate or work out because it would never change the course of the election. If you had a serious movement that would alter the apparent result of the election, because a group of very obscure individuals, you know, party hacks or whatever, had rightly or wrongly decided that Donald Trump was not fit to be president, I think we'd have a real crisis of legitimacy. It's a very important part of any Democratic regime. The transfers of power from one party to the other ought to take place under, you know, the best circumstances possible. And if you were to have a kind of group of rogue electors or faithless electors, however you want to characterize them, even acting with good motives, because I certainly share their doubts about Trump's capacity, I would really worry about the even greater damage that they might do to our political and constitutional system.
And again, I'm speaking with Jack Rakoff, who's a professor of history and American studies at Stanford University, who was awarded the 1997 Pulitzer Prize for History for his book, Original Meanings, Politics and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution. And his latest book is Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. Now, the fact that there's a certain ambiguity in the Article 5 of the Constitution in relation to the Electoral College, to my mind, is also, you know, consistent with the sort of genius of the Constitution in the sense that there has always been this sort of ambiguous tension between the individual and the state that keeps the constitutional alive. And it seems like they deliberately designed it in that way. But in terms of what Alexander Hamilton specifically said about the Electoral College, and particularly relevant to what we're discussing today, and particularly with Donald Trump about to assume the presidency, Alexander Hamilton said that the Electoral College was meant to, quote, ensure that the office of the president will never fall to the lot of any man who is not in an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications. I'm sorry to.
Yes, I'm well aware of the passage.
Well, I just can't contain the obvious. Right. You know, I mean, if ever there was somebody, at least to my mind, that's not qualified, and of course, more than the majority of the Americans, by about 3 million, also agree with me that this man is not qualified. So.
Well, yeah. Hamilton also said it was a moral certainty that something like our current situation would not happen.
Right, right. So, but this current situation is far from the warning of having this mechanism, because it's clearly backfired, has it not? I mean, this is not. This is somebody who actually won by specifically going after the Electoral College, and he didn't get. I don't think he's not in the slightest bit bothered by the 3 million deficit in the popular vote. In fact, he said he won by a landslide, a huge landslide.
Well, yeah, and Trump says a lot of things that turn out not to be true, and you know, he's also argued that if he really wanted to win the national popular vote too, he could have done it, but he just had a different strategy. This may be the election either that proves Hamilton wrong, or hopefully it'll be the exception that proves the rule. I think the deeper question one has to consider, and this is not the easiest problem to wrap one's mind around, is what is there about the American system that says a popular plurality or majority in the vote cast by citizens is less important than the electoral scorecard, run up in the Electoral College. And when you think about this issue, what I think it means is that for some reason, the defenders of the Electoral College like to argue that somehow a state-based system of voting, one of which we have, in effect, 51 elections, counting the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, is somehow better than just a general popular vote. The usual argument made for this is that somehow having the state-based system also preserves our basic structure of federalism, that there's some kind of integral relationship between the mode of presidential election and the underlying security of the federal system. And I think that's just a gross error for a variety of reasons. The most important one is that there are any of a number of ways in which the structure of our Constitution and our political practices protect the federal system. I mean, the very way in which Congress is elected, with members of the House of Representatives coming from geographically defined districts within a state, and then two senators representing each of the states, that seems to provide a kind of adequate basis for protecting the basic values of federalism. So, of course, there's the fact that, different governments have different functions. The boundaries of those functions shift over time, but they shift because, the American people, in effect, will that to be the case. The idea that the presidential election is somehow important, but that having a state-based system electing a president is better than having a general popular vote, the idea that this is somehow essential to the defense of federalism seems to me to be a terrible myth. It reflects the existence of the federal system, but it doesn't really protect it.
Well, but my understanding is that the reason that the states control the elections was that was the initial deal breaker in organizing the Constitution, that the 13 colonies made that. They insisted on that, did they not, that they wanted to control their own elections?
Well, I wouldn't put that strongly. It's important to remember that in Article 1 of the Constitution, which is the congressional article, you'll find what's known as the Times, Places, and Manner Clause. So, in effect, what that does is, in terms of elections of members of Congress, the states have the first pass at this. The states have a basis for defining who gets to vote. Would you have district elections? Would you have statewide elections of members of the House of Representatives? Would you vote for a representative just from your own district? Could you vote for a representative from any district? There's a whole variety of possibilities that, in fact, were practiced in the early decades of the Republic. But Congress, Congress corrected that. I think in 1842, it passed a district law which required all the states to set up congressional districts for the election of the House of Representatives. So Congress could always override the state procedures for the election of both members of the House of Representatives and senators doesn't really matter, And they could actually use that authority to regulate the election of the president. If, for example, we could decide what is the one best method of voting, speaking technologically, what kind of voting system do we want to use? Congress could use its legislative authority to say this is how congressional elections have to be conducted. And since congressional elections always coincide with presidential elections, it would have an effective way to really to standardize the national ballot. And this is a non-trivial issue because one of the other objections to having a national popular election is, well, God, what would happen if you had to have a recount? It would be really chaotic. In fact, during the hearing or the forum we had in the Judiciary Committee a few days ago, this was a point that one of its former members, Representative Bobby Scott from Virginia, kept making. And, you know, it's a fair point, but it neglects the fact that Congress has the authority to really improve and standardize how elections would be conducted. So the states get the first pass at it. But there's actually a national authority existing already that would allow Congress to correct or revise or reform what was being done at the state level.
Well, again, any reforms in this regard seem to end up with the need for a constitutional amendment, which is a huge, heavy lift, and we've discussed
that. Well, no, you know, Ian, not this one. Right. I mean, if, in fact, you wanted to say, if Congress wanted to say, here is the one, you know, manner of voting, here is the one technique we insist must be used to regulate the election of members of Congress, and then just link it, which I think would happen naturally, to the election of the president, it has that authority already. If you want to get rid of the Electoral College, I happen to think, and replace it with a national popular vote, I happen to think that in the end, the only way to do it would be by a constitutional amendment. And, of course, that raises some serious problems. But we can't, you know, if we don't want to talk about the problem, we can never confront it. If we start talking about it, at least we might find a way to deal with it.
Well, I was about to say though that, you know, voting on Tuesdays, we're the only democracy that doesn't vote over the weekends, and our history seems to be about making it more difficult to vote than making it easier to vote with registration and different states' rules and deadlines. And, I mean, it's unbelievable how much easier it is to vote everywhere else in the world except here in the United States. You know, to change, for example, the vote to the weekend would require a constitutional amendment. But again, there are creative ways around it. Bernie Sanders.
No, Ian, that's not true.
Really?
I don't think that's true. Again, the time, places, and manner clause of Article 1 gives Congress the authority to regulate that. If Congress, you know, I mean, Congress could nationally stand. I think I'm right about this. Maybe you should run this by some election lawyers. But I'm fairly confident to say that Congress already has the constitutional authority to make those kinds of decisions. I mean, it's Congress that said we actually have to vote, you know, first for electors and then for members of the House of Representatives on the same day. It used to be the 19th century that elections would take place, you know, literally all through the, you know, all through the calendar of an election year. Congress standardized that. First, the presidential electors, I think, in 1842, and then for members of the House of Representatives in 1873. So you don't need an amendment for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say that that the workaround that I had heard from Senator Bernie Sanders was I think he's tried to offer this bill, which is to make Election Day a public holiday. All I was suggesting, Jack, is that there are many ways to skin a cat, you know.
Well, you know, I agree. Right. There's a variety of reforms you could do. You're certainly right to say, look, the basic story of the United States is, in fact, in some ways, in, you know, recent years, we have liberalized voting procedures. It used to be that everybody had to vote on Election Day or cast an absentee ballot or if you're going to be, you know, away from your state or your constituency. Now we've kind of expanded, the range of, the voting period. And then in response to that, in particular states, particularly given the political animus of the Republican Party, we've tried to cut back on that. So in one sense, it's grown more liberal, but then there's been this pronounced reaction to it, attempt to make it more difficult, I think particularly for, you know, racial and ethnic minorities to vote. So it's kind of an active area of contestation, but you're right, we're way behind other countries.
So back to the Electoral College and its future, which you were at a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee, you testified before this week in Washington, Jack Rakoff. We've had these what they call misfires recently, one in 2001 in this year, where the popular vote is the winner of the popular vote is the loser of the election. And we had could have had a misfire, theoretically, in 2004 had John Kerry gotten a few more votes in Ohio. And then he would have been faced with the situation of being, I think Bush was actually about 2 million or 1.5 million ahead in the popular vote.
And no, actually 3 million.
He was 3 million. Oh, well, then yeah, so you'd have a similar similar situation to the one you have now. And I don't believe for 1 minute that John Kerry could have governed the country. So that, to my mind, is the real issue here, is how can you have an electoral system in a country that has that is so divided as this one, where elections are supposed to, you know, be finite. They're supposed to give you a resolution. But if you keep ending up with ambiguity, then, you know, it's really untenable.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, you could also, you could in 1976 to this list, go back and look at the Carter-Ford dispute, or the Carter-Ford contest. It actually, I think, 3,000 votes in Hawaii and 5,000 votes in Ohio would have swung the election from Carter to Ford. In fact, you know, I think there have been 5 occasions when we've got the kind of disparity we have here, but there have been a number of others where we really were within striking distance. But yeah, I'm not sure I agree with your conclusion. I mean, it would have, you know, back in 2000, briefly towards the end, the Bush campaign threatened, believing that Bush would have the popular plurality, but Gore would have the electoral majority. There were stories at the time saying that the Bush people would want electors to reconsider what they should do. Of course, they got the opposite result. Gore had the plurality and Bush had the electoral majority by a handful of votes. So that, and then Gore decided not to contest the Electoral College in that way. I think in 2004, I think Bush would have done the right thing. I think for me, the unfortunate part of that is, had Bush been defeated in 2004, the same way Gore had been defeated in 2000, then both parties would have been victimized in the same way 4 years apart. And that would have made it much easier, I think, at least I hypothesize, to build a bipartisan consensus. And say if both parties had lost the presidency for the same set of reasons, then Americans in general, and the parties in particular, might have been more willing to focus on the zaniness, the irrationality of this system. But, you know, for better or for worse, Bush won a re-election. That was a 120,000 vote margin in Ohio. So, you know, it was small, but, you know, non-trivial.
Sure. Well, Jack Rakoff, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. And I encourage all your listeners to think seriously about this issue. It's a really serious one.
I think a lot of them already are. They're kind of sore about broken system. And again, I've been speaking with Jack Rakoff. He's a professor of history and American studies at Stanford University. He was awarded the 1997 Pulitzer Prize for History for his book, Origins, Original Meanings, Politics and the Ideas in the Making of the Constitution. And his latest book is Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. And he testified this week before a hearing of the House Judiciary Committee about the future of the Electoral College.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.